Reverend Cooper, reel four.
After the battle itself was concluded and the Argentines had surrendered, we found ourselves in Goose Green, the only troops there, quite a long way from the rest of the task force, with more than a thousand Argentine prisoners. The villagers that we'd released from the village hall, and in that case there were perhaps 100, 120, who couldn't at that point go back to their houses because either the houses had been totally wrecked internally, or in some cases they'd been booby-trapped as well. In addition to this, inevitably there were large quantities of Argentine arms and ammunition lying about, as well as containers of napalm, some of which were leaking. And the whole situation was a total and sort of administrative nightmare. We obviously tried to and initially set up a defence in case there should be an Argentine counter-attack, or indeed if there had been Argentines who hadn't surrendered and who were out in the surrounding countryside who might have decided to try to cause some trouble. I got the specific task of collecting the dead, and immediately our first problem was that of accounting for our own missing, and not helped by the fact that Dave Woods, the adjutant, was one of the dead. So I suggested that the next adjutant, who in fact had been nominated though hadn't been due to take up the appointment for a while, who was Mal Worsley Tonks, who was OIC Mortars at that time, I suggested that he could perhaps take on the adjutant's job immediately, since he'd got a very competent warrant officer who could easily run the mortars, and that together with Mal Simpson, the RSM, we could perhaps start sorting out who our dead were and trying to account for any who were still missing, who we didn't know were dead. A couple of years before, we'd had a number of soldiers killed at Warren Point in Northern Ireland on the day that Mountbatten was killed, and they were killed outside our battalion area, and there'd been some difficulty in establishing who the dead were, and one or two mistakes had been made. Some wives had been told that their husband was dead when he wasn't, and others had been told their husband was alive when in fact he was dead. So we decided that we'd be right this occasion and that we wouldn't release any names until we were certain that they were dead. And to this end, we agreed that I would personally identify dead at the battlefield end, and our RSM would go back to Ajax Bay and personally identify dead bodies there. So any bodies that had found their way back to Ajax Bay without going through the battalion system would be identified by Mal Simpson, and I, in collecting the dead from the battlefield, would then personally identify the dead that I collected. We then got a list of missing from each of the rifle companies and support company, and tried to establish as best we could where they'd last been seen. I then compared that list with the clerk in the regimental aid post, and from his list of casualties that had been through, I could delete a large number of the names that I had. Of those names that companies had supplied me, in most cases they could also tell me quite sort of certainly that the person was dead, if that obviously were the case. So really I ended up after that exercise, before we actually started looking for bodies, with a list of those who I was fairly sure were dead, and a very small list indeed, of those who hadn't been through the RAP, who companies had reported missing, and who we really didn't know what had happened to them. The next problem was accounting for the dead, or collecting the dead, with the scant resources we had. I was fortunately able to use a Marine BV This is one of the tracked snow vehicles that they normally use in Norway, which had come down with a marine company the morning that the Argentine surrendered. And that vehicle was able to take me around the battlefield where we could collect the dead, and I had a small party of soldiers in the back to help me. I was still very concerned, though, that we knew that the Argentines had planted mines, but nobody seemed to be able to tell us where they were, and we'd still no guarantee that all the Argentines had indeed surrendered. So it was with a degree of anxiety that we set off, and we collected dead from those places where companies were able to tell us that they had actually left them. These included the dead who were killed with Jim Barry by the schoolhouse, who'd been killed under very confusing circumstances when the initial story was, anyway, that Jim had gone forward to take an Argentine surrender because white flags had appeared around the schoolhouse, and he and a corporal, and I think it was a lance corporal with him, had been shot. I think it probably was a genuine mistake, if that's the right word. I don't think it was a plan on the part of the Argentines to lure British soldiers out. I think it was just one of those things. But we collected the dead, four or five from that particular part of the battlefield, and then we went over the remainder of the battlefield over towards Boker House, where we knew there were others. The going was a bit difficult, partly because the area was crisscrossed with the command cables from Milan, and of course each time we saw one we had to stop, and I then went forward and inspected it to see whether it was a control wire from a missile or whether it was simply a trip wire, as perhaps part of a mine system. In every case they turned out to be cables from Milan, and we successfully collected our dead. Having got them in the back of the vehicle, we took them back to Goose Green, where I was told that there was no possibility of a helicopter for at least 24 hours to get them back to San Carlos. But it did mean at least I could identify them. Whilst I'd been out on the first day, one patrol of four men who'd been missing walked back into our lines, and they'd been caught out behind Argentine lines and had simply gone to ground. A patrol from our C company, patrols company. And that more or less completed my figures, and I contacted Mal Simpson at San Carlos, and he was happy about his work at that end. So we were then able to actually provide a list to Brigade of those who we knew were dead and whose bodies we had actually got hold of. There'd been a bit of pressure from Brigade because obviously people back in England wanted to know who the dead were as soon as possible. But we resisted that pressure until we could be certain, and I think it probably did cause some difficulty back here, particularly perhaps for our family's officer, when the families knew that we'd been involved in a fight and that we'd had casualties, but that it took a good probably 36 hours, maybe even nearly 48 hours, before we could actually get the casualty names back to UK. Even so, I did notice when I got back sometime afterwards and looked through the initial list that in just about every case that the cause of death was inaccurate, and that on the first telling, as it were, families in general had been given as the cause of death that which in fact wasn't. It perhaps seems a detail, but I think in my experience, relatives do want to know really quite precisely what the cause of death was. But I think in most of those cases the matter was straightened out subsequently when those who were with their husband or son, when he was killed, saw wives and parents and put them more fully in the picture. But I then put the bodies in the garden at the back of the house that we were using as a headquarters in Goose Green, and told the sentry that as part of his task he had to also keep an eye on these bodies, because I was concerned that there were a number of dogs walking around the settlement, loose, and I didn't know when they'd last been fed or what state they were in, and I was concerned that these bodies might be seen as a source of food by these dogs. I remember to this day the rather stunned expression on the soldier's face when I told him that there were seven or eight bodies at the back, and he'd got to regularly check them. I'm not quite sure why he seemed a bit taken aback, but presumably it was the last thing he expected. And the day after, I was able to get them on a helicopter, and they were flown back to Ajax Bay, where I believe that they'd been buried. In the meantime, we still had large numbers of Argentine dead to do something about, really. And we began to collect these dead with the help of Argentine work parties. The Argentine prisoners had been put into the sheds where sheep were kept, and I believe where they were housed until at the time that they were sheared. But the Argentines seemed prepared to help with the collection of their dead, and I went with Rod Bell, who was the marine interpreter, and contacted the senior officer. And really, my line was quite simple. I said, "Look, I was collecting his dead soldiers, and I knew already that a number of them had no identification of any sort on them. Some had got identification discs, but a lot had got no means of identification." And what I asked him was that if I told him which part of the battlefield we were working on, if he could let me have an NCO or an officer who'd served in that part, we could at least begin to cobble together some sort of list of Argentine casualties. I suppose I did it for two reasons. One was humanitarian. I thought that there would be relatives who would need, and obviously would need to know what had happened to their sons or husbands. And I also thought it was probably a subject that could subsequently become quite politically sensitive over how the Argentine dead had been treated. But I was a bit taken aback when this Argentine officer said he didn't need any help, that he already knew who he'd lost, and basically wasn't prepared to help identify any of his dead men. And I tried again through Rod Bell, and he was quite adamant that he didn't want to help us in any way, and that indeed he didn't need our help in identifying his dead, who he insisted he knew already who they were. Well, I was really quite tired. I'd made my offer. I certainly wasn't, there wasn't a lot more I could do about that. I'd made contact with, I think there were three Argentine chaplains who'd gone into the bag at Goose Green. The senior one was the only one who would deal with us, and I think that was probably by agreement. But since he didn't speak English, he himself was an Italian, I certainly didn't speak Italian, the best we could do was get by with French, which I'm by no means very good at, and I don't think, in truth, he was a lot better. But I'll come back to this in a few minutes. So we set about collecting the Argentine dead, and we really collected them, laid them out, and the plan was that we would bury them. But when that plan became known to the Argentine, sorry, to the islanders in Goose Green and Darwin, it became quite clear that they weren't going to have Argentines dead or alive on the islands. And before we could really go any further, we had to get the cooperation of the islanders in the burial of these dead Argentines. I suppose without thinking, Chris Keeble's first plan was, or first idea was, that we'd just bury them in the cemetery that was just inland from Darwin. But we very quickly realised that would never be acceptable to the islanders, and indeed it was probably a fairly insensitive thing to think about. So we just simply decided that it would have to be a trench grave that we would dig, and that would be the best we could do. Eventually, the islanders did come round to it. They did recognise that we couldn't just throw the bodies in the sea, which was their first suggestion. And as we said, well, you know, if we're prepared to give them a decent burial, and after all, we were the ones that were fighting them, the least the islanders could do was to go along with it, and who knew what would happen in the longer term. But they came round, and indeed they lent us the means of moving the bodies by way of a tractor and a trailer. Though before the actual burial itself took place, I'd moved on with Tupara, and that task was left to the Gurkhas, and indeed they were buried with the assistance of the Roman Catholic chaplain of 5 Brigade, who also had the Argentine chaplain present as well. I'd made the point from the start, as soon as we started shipping prisoners back to Ajax Bay, that the chaplain had to stay until the funeral had been done. Again, I felt that for a variety of reasons, and not least of all political reasons, there had to be an Argentine chaplain present when the Argentine dead were buried. So he was there, and he took part in the burial, though by that time I'd moved on with the battalion to Bluff Cove. Now, I can't remember precisely when it was, but it had been a day or so after we'd taken Goose Green. The Argentines were moving artillery ammunition from the Argentine gun position, which was perhaps 50 metres from the sheds in which the Argentine prisoners were being kept. When we'd first moved into the settlement, I'd noticed this gun position, and one thing that struck me about it was that the Argentine gunnery wasn't that good, but it wasn't as bad as was suggested by the state of the gun position, because behind the gun position, where the ammunition was, it wasn't only the ammunition itself for the guns, which were 105 light howitzers, pack howitzers, but there was a lot of small arms ammunition and a lot of boxes that got mines written on them, and the whole place, the whole area was just totally chaotic. There was no order there, and that was inconsistent with the effectiveness of the Argentine artillery. And I remarked on this to Chris Keevil and said he thought it was a bit curious, and he said yes, he thought it was odd and suspected that the ammunition, that it may have been booby-trapped, and that he'd asked Ato to inspect it. Well, the day after, when I spoke to him again, he said Ato had looked at it and said, no, it's all absolutely clear, it's just the way the ammunition had been dumped by the Argentines. So when the Argentines came and said they wanted the ammunition to be moved because they feared that it was too close to the sheds where they were accommodated, and that if there were, say, an air attack and that ammunition should go off, they'd be at risk. And I think it was a fair point, but the problem we had was that we simply didn't have the manning to move the ammunition, which we told the Argentines. They said they'd provide the work party, and after we'd made it quite clear that they couldn't be obliged to work, and indeed if they were volunteering and they did work, they'd actually be paid for it in terms of the Geneva Convention, they started to move this ammunition. Well, I was in the building at the opposite end of the settlement that we were using for the RAP, and on and off throughout each day after the battle, we'd heard the odd explosion of either a mine going off, presumably because it had been detonated by some animal, or maybe it just got bored with sitting around doing nothing. But then there was one bang which was significantly more powerful than the rest, and it shook the building. And we were sort of looking at each other when the door burst open and the soldier ran in and said, "There's been an explosion down by the prisoners' pens. We'd better get down there." So the RAP grabbed its bags, and I ran across the settlement and found a soldier struggling with a stretcher. So I got hold of one end of it, and he got hold of the other, and we ran off with that. And quite clearly, the explosion had been in this pile of ammunition at the back of the Argentine gun position. Before we reached it, there was one casualty on the ground who was being attended to, and I left this soldier with the stretcher there and ran on towards the gun position. Where the explosion had been was a fire, which I think had been obviously caused by the explosion, but some of the charge bags in the artillery propellant was burning quite fiercely. There was a soldier again with a stretcher trying to get over a fence, and he seemed to be making a bit of a ham job over it. So I remember grabbing the stretcher from him and throwing it over the fence and climbing after it. And for some reason, he didn't follow. And I then ran towards the flames, where there was a sergeant from the medical corps who'd pulled one of the bodies out of the fire. And as I ran towards him, Mal Simpson was trying to get a fire extinguisher going. And I remember him shouting at me to keep clear because there was ammunition still in the flames. I didn't really think it was worth detouring. I thought I was close enough anyway, so if there was anything going to go off, it wouldn't make much difference whether I was on the path I was following or a slightly wider one. So I carried on and pulled this Argentine casualty clearer from the flames. He'd lost both his legs, one at the thigh and one just below the knee, and he'd lost an arm from the elbow down. In the case of all these injuries, or these losses of limbs, the bone was still there. It was simply the flesh that had been taken away from the limbs. And he'd got quite a large wound from the base of his chest down into his abdomen, but was still alive and was still conscious. But we dragged him, I say, away from the flames and began to try to put a drip in him, and Mal Simpson was still shouting that there was ammunition in the flames and that we were still fairly well exposed. So I said, come on, we better move him again. So we then moved him well clear and took him, in fact, around the back of one of the buildings in the area. He was clearly in a pretty bad way. We got the a line into him, put a drip into him, and by now he'd become unconscious. And we'd got him on a stretcher, and we needed to move him again so that we could get him round to the Land Rover that was taking casualties back to the RAP. And there was no way that we two could really move him effectively. And I saw out of the corner of my eye a pair of Wellington boots, and I shouted to whoever it was to come and give us a hand, and nothing happened. And when I looked up, I realised it was Tony Wilson, the 5 Brigade commander, who must have arrived at that moment. It certainly wasn't a very pleasant sight for him to see, just walking into it. And it seemed to have shaken him to the point of total inactivity and really indeed incapacity to think. I think he was just too stunned. Anyway, Pete Adams, one of our platoon commanders, arrived, and between us we moved this stretcher round to the Land Rover, and he was driven off to the building that I left, which was, to say, in use as the RAP. Again, we couldn't communicate with any of these people, and not just the one that I'd been involved with, but any of the other casualties. But again, I remembered that the chaplain spoke French. So I then ran round to the sheds where all the prisoners were, and I asked for him, got him out, and ran with him up to the regimental aid post, where at least there was one person who could speak French, and I felt that we could communicate in that way. It was quite clear to me that there were going to be Argentine dead as well, and again, given that they were Roman Catholic, and I felt it would probably not be unreasonable that they had their chaplain there. So I took him up, said, to the RAP. On the way, I ran into Bob Fox, the correspondent, who I knew spoke Italian. And I said, would he be able to help us? And he rather put me in a quandary. He said, well, I would like to. He said, but I've got a story to get back, and I've got a helicopter coming, and if I don't get this, I miss my slot on Marisat as well. And I said, well, yeah, I think it's probably more important that you go and get your story back, because nobody back at home will yet have known anything about what we've been doing. And I thought it was probably a good thing that families did at least on the news hear something about what we'd been doing. And I felt that we could probably cope through French and this Italian priest. So Bob Fox went off in his helicopter when it arrived. And I went back to the RAP, where there were a number of these casualties, some suffering from really quite severe burns. The one I'd been involved with was still alive, and indeed he was still alive when he was medevaced, though he did die subsequently. One of the casualties had been put in my sleeping bag, which I didn't mind at all, though after that particular time, whenever I got into my sleeping bag, all I could smell was burnt flesh. And eventually we got the casualties out and restored some sort of order. I'm still not certain, I'm quite confident that the ammunition was booby-trapped, but given that Ato had looked at it, I suppose I got to say I can't be certain that it was. But I can't see any other way that there could have been the kind of explosion that there was, had it not been initiated by some device that would cause the bang that we heard, which I think was probably two or three 105 HE rounds going off. The actual explosion itself, in addition to the fellow who I was involved with, killed another two Argentines outright, and there was a third who was caught in the flames, who it was really quite impossible to reach, and one of our soldiers shot him, which I think was probably the best thing he could have done under the circumstances. But it shook us a bit, made us even more aware, I suppose, that you couldn't really lower your guard, that there wasn't such a thing as a totally safe area. But by this time, all the houses had been cleared and the villagers were at least back in their own accommodation as far as could be. And we were really in a situation of trying to fill in the gaps in the battalion and just reshuffle companies about, bring reinforcements forward, and a number of soldiers who'd been in the echelon, Remy and Catering Corps, so on, came forward and began to fill some of the gaps that had been created in companies by the casualties at Goose Green. I suppose the next thing of any significance for me was when I heard through some of our soldiers that a Navy pilot had been shot down. I think his name was Nick Taylor, who'd been shot down on the 1st of May at Goose Green, had been buried up near the racecourse. Well, I didn't know where the racecourse was, and I didn't know greatly about the pilot, but I decided I ought to try to find the grave if there was one. And since one of the buildings in the settlement had produced quite a quantity of bits and pieces of escape equipment from a Harrier, as well as the remnants of a parachute and other odds and ends from an ejector seat, it did look as though there might be some truth in the rumour. Anyway, I went for a walk around, and eventually I did find the grave of this pilot. And I took some photographs of it, and I noted its position, and then sent that back to brigade through battalion headquarters. And I heard from one of the pilots who came by that the fellow had a friend in one of the squadrons. The pilot gave me his name, and I wrote to him and said that I had located the grave and indeed had taken photographs of it, and if he, or indeed any other the dead man's relatives, wanted photographs at any time, if they contacted me, I'd let them have them. I never had any reply to that, but then I didn't really expect any reply. But at least we'd found the grave, we'd told Brigade, so any uncertainty about his death could at least be cleared up. And I suppose the next event, really, was...